Prelude in the Upper Circles. In the upper circles of the hierarchy at this time, there was felt, as always on such occasions, a mild yet poignant satisfaction, an agreeable, sly sense of I told you so, expressed in glances from under lowered lashes and round little mouths discreetly drawn down. Once again had the cup run over, once more had patience been exhausted, justice fallen due, and quite against his own wish or will, under pressure from the kingdom of the stern, which in any case the world was unable to resist, since one had never succeeded in making it stand up on the unstable and yielding foundations of sheer mercy and compassion, he, the Almighty, in majestic affliction, had seen himself driven to step in and clean up, to overturn, to destroy, and only after that to even off again, as it had been at the time of the flood, and on the day of the rain of fire and brimstone, when the salt sea had swallowed up the wicked cities. This time, of course, the concession to justice was not on such an appalling scale as in that earlier attack of remorse, and the ensuing wholesale drownings. It did not compare with that other occasion, when, thanks to the perverted sense of beauty of the people of Sodom, an unspeakable city tax had almost been exacted from two of us. No, this time, it was not all mankind that had fallen into the pit, nor even some portion of it, the corruption of whose ways had cried to heaven. This was a matter of but one single specimen of the breed, albeit an uncommonly taking and self-complacent one, more than usually well equipped with the advantages of nepotism and long-standing design in his favor, and we had had our noses rubbed into him on account of a whim, a train of thought, only too familiar to the heavenly host, where it was the source of much bitterness, though also of the not unjustified hope that very soon the shoe would be on the other foot, and the bitterness the portion of him who had set the train of thought in motion. The angels, so ran the train of thought, are created after our image, but yet not fruitful. The beasts, on the other hand, lo, they are fruitful, but not after our likeness. Let us create man, an image of the angels, yet fruitful withal. Fantastic. Worse than merely futile, it was far-fetched, extravagant, pregnant with remorse and bitterness. We were not fruitful, not we. We were courtiers of the light, sober-minded chamberlains, one and all. The story about our one time going in unto the children of men was simply irresponsible gossip. But everything considered, and whatever interesting advantages the animal quality of fecundity might prove to have over and above its animality, at all events we unfruitful ones did not drink injustice like water, and one should see how far one would get with one's notions about fruitful angels. Perhaps far enough to see that an Almighty with self-control and prudent forethought for his own peace of mind might better let matters rest once and for all at our decent and honorable form of existence. Unlimited power, unlimited possibility of taking into one's head, producing out of it, and bringing into being by a mere let there be, such gifts had, of course, their dangers. Even all wisdom might not be quite adequate to avoid all the blunders and waste motions in the practice of absolute qualities like these. Out of sheer restlessness and lack of exercise, out of the purest much once more, out of a capricious craving to see, after the angel and the brute, what a combination of the two would be like, out of all these motives, and impelled by them, one entangled oneself in folly, and created a being notoriously unstable and embarrassing. And then, precisely because it was such an undeniable miscreation, one set one's heart upon it in magnificent self-will, and made such a point of the thing that all heaven was offended. Now, was it true that he had come on this idea all by himself and of his own accord? Speculations to the contrary were rife in the hierarchy, albeit only in whispers and not susceptible of proof. Plausible, however, they were, and according to them, the whole thing went back to a suggestion made by the great Shamiel, who at that time, before his luminous fall from on high, had stood very near the throne. The idea sounded very like him. And why, forsooth? Because it was his business to realize and bring into the world evil, his very own thought, which nobody else either knew or cared about, and because the enrichment of the world's repertory through evil could be achieved in no other way than just precisely by the creation of man. Among the fruitful animal creation, evil, Shemuel's great invention, did not come into question, and certainly not among us unfruitful images of God. For it to come into the world, there was needed just the very creature which Shemuel, according to the hypothesis, had proposed, an image of God, which at the same time was fruitful. In other words, man. It did not necessarily follow that the Almighty had been hoodwinked. Shemuel, in his usual grandiose way, had probably not concealed the consequences of the proposed creation, in other words, the origin of evil, but had come out quite forthright and forcibly with it, though in our circles we guessed that he also said a lot about how much livelier it would make life for the Creator, for instance, by the need to exercise mercy and pity, judgment and correction, or by the appearance in the world of merit and demerit, reward and punishment, in other words, by the origin of the good, a phenomenon bound up with that of evil. The good, indeed, had actually had to depend upon its opposite, waiting for existence in the limbo of the merely possible. Thus it was clear that creation rested upon division, which had even begun simultaneously with the separation of light from darkness, and the all-power would only be consistent in going on from this exterior position to create the moral world. The view was widespread in the hierarchy that this had been the argument by which the great Shemuel had flattered the throne and won it over to his counsels. Highly malicious counsels they were, of course. One could not help sniggering at their slyness, however much it had been disguised by the rude frankness the malice clothed itself in. With that malice, it must be said, the upper circles did not altogether lack sympathy. The core of Shemuel's malice lay here. If the beasts, though possessing the gift of fruitfulness, were not created in God's image, we of the hierarchy were not either, strictly speaking, since that property, God be praised, we were clean of. Now, the properties of godlikeness and fruitfulness, which we divided between our two groups, were originally united in the Creator himself, and thus the new creation suggested by Shemuel would be the only one actually and literally after the Creator's own image. With this being, then, in other words, man, evil came into the world. That was a joke to make anyone snigger. The very creature which, if you like, was nearer to the image of the Creator than any other, brought evil with him into the world. Thus God, on Shemuel's advice, created for himself a mirror which was anything but flattering. Often and often, in anger and chagrin, he was moved to smash it to bits, though he never quite did, perhaps because he could not bring himself to re-plunge into nothingness that which he had summoned forth, and actually cared more about the failure of than he did about any success. Perhaps, too, he would not admit that anything could be a complete failure after he had created it so thoroughgoingly in his own image. Perhaps, finally, a mirror is a means of learning about oneself. And he was later to be confronted, in a son of man, a certain Abiram, or Abraham, by the consciousness of that equivocal creature as a means to his own self-knowledge. Man, then, was a result of God's curiosity about himself. Shemuel had shrewdly divined the curiosity, and had exploited it in his advice. Vexation and chagrin had been the inevitable and lasting effect, especially in the by no means rare cases where evil was united with bold intelligence, logic, and pugnacity, as it was in Cain. The story of the first fratricide and his conversation with God after the deed was known in some detail to the upper circles and industriously circulated. God had not come off very well when he asked Eve's son, "What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the earth, which has opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand." For Cain had answered, "Yes, I have slain my brother, and it is all very sad. But who created me as I am? Jealous to that extent that under provocation my whole bearing is changed, and I no longer know what I am doing. Art not thou a jealous God? And hast thou not created me after thy image? Who put in me the evil impulse to the deed which I undeniably committed? Thou sayest that thou alone bearest the whole world, and wilt not bear our sins?" Not so bad. Quite as if Cain, or Cain, had taken counsel beforehand with Shemuel, though probably the hot-headed rascal had needed no advice. Rejoinder would not have been easy. There could be only bitter laughter, or a crushing blow. "Get out," was what he had said. "Go thy ways. A fugitive and vagabond shalt thou be. But I will make thee a sign that thou belongest to me, and no one may slay thee." In short, Cain, thanks to his logic, came off better than unscathed. There could be no talk at all of punishment. Even that about the fugitive and vagabond was not serious. Cain settled in the land of Nod, eastward of Eden, and in peace and quiet begot his children, a work for which he was urgently needed. At other times, as is well known, punishment descended. Frightfulness was invoked. There was majestic affliction at the compromising conduct of the most like creature. Again there were rewards, extravagant rewards. We need only recall Hanok or Enoch, and the incredible, between ourselves, the quite irresponsible benefits that fell into the fellow's lap. In the circles and ranks, the view was held, and cautiously passed about, that in the world below there was great lack of even-handed justice, that the moral world, established by Shemuel's advice, was not dealt with in a properly serious spirit. It did not need much, there were times when it needed nothing at all, to convince the hierarchy that Shemuel took the moral world much more seriously than he did. It could not be disguised, even where it ought to have been, that the rewards, disproportionate as they were in some cases, were actually only a sort of rationalization of blessings, which at bottom were nothing but an arbitrary playing of favorites, with almost no moral aspect at all. And the punishments? Well, for instance, just now, in Egypt, punishment and reduction to the ranks were taking place. There was compliance, apparently painful and reluctant, with the dictates of the moral world. A certain dashing and arrogant young darling, a dreamer of dreams, a scion of that stock which had hit on the idea of being a medium of self-knowledge to God, had come down to the pit, to the prison and the grave, and for the second time, because his folly had passed all bounds, and he had let love, as before he had hate, get entirely out of hand. But we onlookers, perhaps we were deceiving ourselves in our satisfaction at this particular version of the fire and brimstone. Just between ourselves, we were not being deceived, at bottom, not for a moment. We knew precisely, or we accurately guessed, that all this severity was for the benefit of the kingdom of the stern, that he was using the punishment, the instrument of the moral world, to break open a closed alley which had but one, and that an underground exit to the light. That he, with all due respect, was perverting the punishment into a means of further elevation and favor. When we, in passing, made little O-shaped mouths with the corners drawn down, and shot little glances from under our eyelids, we did so because we saw through the whole thing. Disgrace as a vehicle to greater honor, the All-Highest's little game, illuminated the past as well, and shed light on the follies and flippancies which had given cause for punishment and forced him to inflict it. And this light did not come from the moral world, for these earlier failings, from wherever and whomever inspired, God knew, were also revealed as a medium and vehicle to new, extravagant exaltations. In our circles, we were convinced that we knew, more or less, about these devices, partaking as we did, to however limited an extent, in the Creator's all-knowledge. Though even so, out of respect, we could make use of our knowledge only with the greatest caution, self-restraint, and dissimulation. In the merest whisper, it might and should be added that the hierarchy thought it knew still more of matters, steps, undertakings, intentions, maneuvers, secrets of the widest scope, which it would have been wrong to brush aside as mere court gossip. There could be no mention, scarcely even so much as a whisper, and all that happened was the next thing to keeping silent. The slightest movement of lips just slightly curled, and that was all. What sort of matters were these? What were the rumors?